Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, December 1st, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. Continuing our coverage from this year's 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence, this week Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga sits down with Meseret Haliesis to talk about an often overlooked aspect of gender-based violence, financial and economic abuse. Meseret Haliesis is an economic justice and health equity advocate, thought leader, businesswoman, philanthropist, changemaker, and entrepreneur. She is the founder of the Canadian Centre for Women's Empowerment, with a keen interest in addressing systemic barriers and other challenges that prevent women and girls from fully realizing their human rights. Haliesis works to influence public policy decisions that support domestic violence survivors to make a successful transition to economic independence. Here is Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga with Meseret Haliesis in conversation. Take a listen.
So thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today. To start off, you are with the Canadian Centre for Women's Empowerment, and I know you guys do a lot of work on economic abuse. And so I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what that is exactly.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Economic abuse incorporates a range of coercive controlling behavior that are law perpetuator to control someone's economic resources or freedom. Economic abuse is wider definition than financial abuse, which is a term usually used denying or restricting monies or misusing another person's finance. Economic abuse is a little bit broader than even financial abuse, which includes like restricting access for essential services like, you know, food, clothing, medicine, transportation, or denying means of improving your economy, for example, like employment, education, training. So there are also three forms of economic abuse. So the first one is economic control, which is monitoring or restricting the victim's use of access of information about the ability to acquire economic resources. For example, you may have money, you may have assets, you may have resources, but the abuser deliberately restricting you not to use your own resources. The second type of economic abuse is employment sabotage, which is restricting and preventing victims not to work, not to go back to school, not to access any education or employment, you know, services. This will usually done by, for example, if you have a job, perpetrators deliberately, they will deny you to have car, a car key, or sometimes also they will not allow you to use also any transportation, you know, bus ticket because of that. Women, they will not go back to the workforce. And then also another types of employment sabotage is, for example, deliberately perpetuators, you know, kind of like, you know, making you sick. And then so that next day you will not go to your employer. So employer, as you know, you have to be on time. That affect your relationship also your employer. Sometimes also employer, they will harass you at workplace, especially if you are working on customer services. If you work with some, you know, direct services with people, like, you know, such kind of job, it needs attention, but abusers sometimes they will send you a harassing message at workplace and everything. That's a deliberate kind of economic, you know, the employment sabotage. So the other types of economic abuse is employment exploitation, which is misusing and inappropriate the victim's economic resources, using coercively or fraudulently to obtain, for example, credit card, you know, using also resources on behalf of you without your knowledge. So it's all about exploitations. For example, you may have assets, you may have money, you may have also bank account. So abusers, they trick you to take that information and that resources. So finally, after when the relationship is end, usually women, they will struggle and you know, to recover from this form of violence. So economic abuse is very broad and then complex, and it's a hidden form of violence. It's underscored, usually also overlooked form of violence, but it affects disproportionately many Indigenous women, racialized women, gender diverse folks, and also you know, Black and newcomers and refugees as well. And then also this form of violence is a critical barrier for a woman not to leave abusive relationship. And unlike other form of abuse, economic abuse, it doesn't end after separation. It will continue for many, many years, because some women, they go through bankruptcy. Some women, they go through a lot of mental struggle because of the violence. It takes them so long to recover. So it's a very complex form of violence, and it affects 95% of victims of domestic violence.
That 95% of victims, that's a really high number. Why do you think that level of victimization has been, you know, overlooked?
Yeah, because as you know, finances by culture, it's a taboo subject, and many people, they want to keep it as a secret because of many cultural and socioeconomic norms. And violence is also, as you know, it's a taboo with a certain community, especially for women, to talk about financial abuse and domestic violence together. It's so huge. So number one, I think the socioeconomic and then the gender norm is also another barrier. Number two, lack of knowledge. Many women, they don't know that if it's abuse, it seems like normal. It's a normal cycle, but it's not normal. And then the other thing is we don't have any tools, resources, and program in Canada. So women, they don't have any way to educate themselves. Of course, there are some programs and services who deal with gender-based violence, but the financial and the economic aspect is not well addressed in our existing, like, you know, gender-based violence. And then the other challenge is our policy. Our policy doesn't clearly articulate economic abuse, you know. Even we're asking now the government to define economic abuse. There's three forms of economic abuse. It has to be clearly defined, and then it has to be consistent, you know, across all policy-making decisions or any kind of, like, you know, literature or researches we are going to produce. I think that's also another thing. There's also lack of understanding by program developers, because I know it's a critical reason we knew that women, they don't live abusive relationship, but it's not well addressed. And then it's also in line with coercive control. As you know, coercive control is also, it's one of the huge things in Canada right now. So because of this layered, you know, issues, it's very hard, number one, to address. Number two, even to identify and then detangle this issue from gender-based violence and raise awareness. Number three, women even by themselves, it seems like normal. So I think that's the all reasons are the reason still high.
Yeah, can you tell me more about that? You said sometimes women, it seems normal to them. What causes that?
Yeah, because you know what? Money, finance, economy is all about power, right? So the abusers, they already take that power because in abusive relationship, the abuser best friend is taking your power, keeping you in isolated positions, denying you access. So this form of violence have all those three things, you know, what I mentioned. So for a woman, because abuser, the only way they can get power is like taking your economy, you know? So that's the thing. So I think that's the best way to keep you in a cage. And because this is a way how many perpetrators exist, and it's not even clearly like, you know, defined, as I says, in our many program documents. And then even men, even by itself, they don't know even it's abuse. It seems like normal, like restricting women not to go back to school, restricting money to spend on her sanitary pack, which is a basic need. So it's kind of a punishment for many cultures, but that's not the way, you know, it should be perceived. So that's why we are going to educate, like, many publics about this issue is not correct and it's not right. And then the other thing is as well, there is no any bruise, like women who are abused financially will not get any physical bruise or any bleeding or any wound. So it's very hard for a woman even to feel like she's abused by a man. It seems like a power and then a normal relationship. I think those are the things, like, you know, that intersect, I believe.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So it's really normalized. It sounds like the way, you know, sometimes these partnerships interact, or these dynamics between some men and women.
Yes. Yeah. It's all about balancing the power, right? The power dynamic. So because economic empowerment is all about giving a power for a woman. So the best abusers, the best perpetrator, smart perpetrator, you name it, you just take that power so that, like, you'll be nothing, right? So, like, that's the best way to keep you in a trap and then to abuse as well. So that's the reason many women, they don't leave abusive relationship.
And so what would you say to someone who might be experiencing this type of abuse and who might think it's normal, like not realizing that, you know, this is, you know, unfair, it's coercive, it's, you know, violent behavior?
Yeah, for someone who have gone through such kind of violence, there is a lot of resources out there. Number one, it's okay to talk to your, like, you know, your counselors, social workers in your community. I know finance is a taboo. Talking about human economy is also, it's a taboo, especially for survivors. So it's okay to talk. And then also it's okay to talk to also your bank, because banks, some banks have some program and services for survivors. Because one of the challenges survivors after they leave abusive relationship is access to credit card, access to joint bank account is a huge problem. So abuser deliberately hold that. So it's okay to discuss with the bank. And the other resources, of course, my organization, Canadian Center for Women Empowerment, we launched our mobile app for survivors. So this mobile app would be also very, you know, a good opportunity to educate themselves. So the mobile app name is called STEARS, S-T-E-A-R. It's Economic Abuse and Financial Abuse mobile app. So women, they can download and educate themselves. They can also develop their own financial safety planning. That's the most important thing. And then the other advice and then suggestion is, before a woman leave abusive relationship, make sure that to check her bank account, to change her PIN numbers, to change also her PIN numbers or any login information on utility, for example, if there's any electronic bills, telecommunication, any bills, you know, she used to pay, it has to be, you know, protected. And then the other advice is make sure also to talk to your credit collectors, either Equifax or TransUnion or any credit association, to make sure you have a good credit before you leave. And then also develop your own financial safety planning, because finance is a little bit challenging after you leave abusive relationship. So having that understanding, it really helps for us to shorten our vulnerability times, you know, after we leave abusive relationship, because to recover from such kind of, you know, abuses, it takes time. So the other suggestions, of course, is talk to also your mental health, talk to also credit, you know, counselors. They will give you an advice on how you could also rebuild your credit. And for those women who had experienced coercive dates, the Canadian Center for Women Empowerment, we have a very good collaboration with Victim Service Toronto. We can refer them and they can get also that services.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So it sounds like a really big part of that, like, you know, in recovering once you're out of this is, you know, getting your finances in order, having that independence and freedom, which kind of leads me to this other question. You know, we know historically women in the workplace are often at a disadvantage. You know, in certain sectors, women, we have lower employment rates. There's a gender pay gap still. So how do labor conditions affect economic abuse for women?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, economic sabotage and employment sabotage is also one of the huge issues for women economic, you know, empowerment. So especially employers, we're also asking, not now actually, in the future, one of our plan is to develop a proper policies and process for a woman who are in the workforce, especially those workforces who have, like, you know, have a lot of like women's, for example, like you can pick like the tourism sectors, right? 50% of employers are women's who are on the tourism industry, like in hotel, restaurant, and those sectors. So what we are actually planning to ask is we need to develop like a standard or a policies and a procedure that shows gender sensitivity for this woman. And plus for survivors of gender-based violence, we need to find a way to develop like a flexible workhouse so that women, they can go back to the workforce. And then the other thing is also, of course, pay equity is also a huge issue. So as you know, we need to develop a gender-sensitive workplace policy that enables women to come to the leadership. And then the other advancement is definitely with regardless of your identity, with regardless of, you know, your color, skins, or your, with regardless of your education status, women, they should have a leadership role. It may be either as a board of directors, it may be also in any kind of decision-making in that organization. I think that really helps women, especially for victims. It gives them a hope, it gives them a light, and also it gives them a power, because the power is already taken by abusers. So imagine if you are a single mom, you have a kids, you're not flexible work hour at workplace. The workplace may not be convenient for you. You're, because of your situation, if you are not qualified to have that position, you'll continue the cycle for generation, right? So when we talk about women advancement, we need to also include those women are invisible, like different demographics and specifically those impacted by gender-based violence. Of course, there are also people and then women who also have disabilities, right? We need to make sure that our workplace is inclusive, everyone.
You know, I guess I'm curious about, have you seen any of these systemic changes that need to happen in the workplace to help, you know, safeguard against this type of economic abuse?
Yes, there are some companies, of course. You know, there is a gender-based violence prevention. I know it's by law. Your workplace has to be safe. Workplace health and then safety is also one of the most important things. I know many organizations, and it's also by law, it's mandatory. But beyond that, we are asking, employment sabotage is the most important thing. Let's say if my abuser harassing me at workplace on phone, that's abuse. But unfortunately, like some employers, they may not understand even it's abuse. It seems like normal. If abuser is restricting me transportation, if I'm late 2-3 days, employer has to understand that. So we need to kind of like work on that. But in terms of change, I don't have any statistics right now to mention that, how many people are changed, which organization. But what I would say is I can see like right now, there is awareness change among financial institutions from our day-to-day advocacy. So many banks, they are understanding survivors' issues because we are asking Canadian banks also to introduce gender-based violence in their program. That enables women to go back to the workforce, to build their economy, to heal and to thrive. So yeah, I can tell you only the financial sectors what we do at this point.
That's good to hear, though, that you're seeing those improvements in the financial sector. Are there any lessons that could be taken from the advocacy that you've done in that sector that could be taken into the workplace sector and you know, improving labor conditions for women?
Sure, yeah. So if we think like, okay, ideally, yeah, we expect women to go back to the workforce, make money, and then to contribute to the economy. But one of the barriers is if you are being impacted by violence, some women, they don't have even the right to access their bank account. So without your bank account, employer, they cannot pay your salary, right? They cannot get this check, you know, your pay stub. So what we have to do right now is one of our like, you know, hope is Canadian banks now, they start to understand gender-based violence is very important. The economy of women is also owned by the bank because bank is the most important sector for many women to go back to also the workforce. So I think like what we have seen is there's a lot of appetite to work with them. We also hosted a very interesting big summit last month. It's called the Financial Future Summit. We invited many bank leaders across Canada, United Kingdom, and Australia. So we share experiences. For example, Australia, they have an amazing program for survivors. So that survivors, they can have products, services from the bank, and they can go back to the workforce. So that's a huge learning experience what we organized last month. And I hope that's a good opportunity for Canadian bank leaders to take that advantage. So the next thing is, of course, to go back to the workplace. One of the barriers is transportation for a woman. Some women, they can't afford. As you know, living cost is high. Some women, they may have a course date before even the pandemic because of the abuser. Now the interest rate is high, living cost is high. So we need to kind of like, so employer has to understand, especially if you are going to hire or if you are going to like, you know, develop or like, you know, create some like job opportunity for this woman. We need to make sure also this understanding is very important because some women, they cannot pay their gas and then their insurance, but they want to go back to the workforce. I think that giving that is also another flexibility. Someone maybe also single mom, like, you know, childcare is also another issue. They want to go back to the workforce and they want to have, you know, a stable job. But the situation because of the child support and because of lack of flexibility of work hours, someone, they prefer to stay at home. So, you know, those are the most important thing we need to see. But in terms of our advocacy, what we have seen is like awareness and knowledge among financial institutions, that's great. And of course, beyond that, of course, women's service organization, of course, they know that this issue is a huge issue for the past many years. But now we are coming together and then talking about also women economic rights, a huge change for us. Because women economy, I know we talk about, everybody talks about women economy, but when you come to gender-based violence, it's like nobody talks about even survivor wealth. You know, we talk about survivors like maybe her like, you know, basic income, it may be, or, you know, disability benefit or social welfare, but we don't talk about their wealth. So what I'm asking is now all organizations also, they have to create a trauma-informed economic empowerment program for a woman, either to start their business, either to go back to the workforce. That's the most important way to break the cycles of, you know, gender-based violence. Otherwise, because of this, women stay there with their abuser. It's very hard for them even to break that chain. So,
yeah, that makes sense. So, building that wealth, definitely, it sounds like will will help, you know, empower and people move forward. You mentioned a lot about, you know, employers understanding and being sympathetic to the situation. What are some signs that people could, you know, keep an eye out for that are signs of economic abuse?
Yeah, for example, if you are an employer, make sure your employee, if she's late repeatedly, it's maybe you never know. And also sometimes some women also, they may not disclose their, like, you know, their physical address. Maybe they may be in shelter. That's also another thing. Sometimes women, they stay away from work because of their sickness, because of mental struggle. Sometimes they may struggle also for childcare. And then the other thing is, of course, some women also, they start to talk about with their, like, you know, their employee. You know, I think we need to create the safe spaces. And then the other sign I would say is, some women, they may ask, you know, extended sick leave. You don't know what's going on. I think we need to flag that as well, in a sense, in a good way. So this woman, she may need a support. So we need to create a safe space for her. We need to make sure that also if she has a safe bank account, you never know that bank account is owned by her abuser. Still, if it's joint, it's very hard for someone to detangle. So those are the most important questions. But what I feel is safe workplace is the most important thing. We need to create a welcoming environment, workplace environment for a woman, because this issue is very devastating for her entire life. Uncertainty is also one of the most devastating, you know, feeling for many women. So I think employer, beyond the current gender-based violence, like, you know, workplace policies, we need to kind of make sure that this is the best workplace for any woman. And then, of course, employer also, I would suggest, like, of course, every organization, they have, like, International Women's Day, you know, a lot of, like, events, you know, outgoing. For example, now we are on the 16 days of activism. So it's good to open up this conversation. Let's talk about financial and economic abuse. Like, you know, let's discuss this issue, because the more you talk it at workplace, people have an awareness. You never know, many women are experiencing your workplace, but lack of knowledge is one of the critical reasons women not to talk as well. So I think employer has to take a responsibility to talk about, like, women economic safety at workplace.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Ravel Radio today.
Okay, bye.
That was Ravel labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga and Meserit Haliesis, a founder of the Canadian Center for Women's Empowerment. Thanks so much for that, Meserit and Gabby. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn it over to Ravel editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, a walkout was held at York University on Tuesday in support of three suspended faculty members. The faculty members were suspended after they were arrested for their alleged participation in a protest against a Chapters Indigo bookstore in Toronto. Posters were put up and red paint was splashed on the building. The protesters were there opposing Indigo's CEO Heather Reisman, whose nonprofit Hesig Foundation provides financial support for foreign nationals seeking to join the Israeli military. During the walkout on Tuesday, students and faculty expressed their outrage that the university would suspend members of their community for engaging in peaceful protest. In labor news, Ravel columnist Tom Sanborn discusses the lethal consequences of class warfare in Bangladesh. In 2013, the collapse of the Rana Plaza garment factory resulted in the deaths of over 1,100 people. Sanborn explains that little has improved for garment workers in the country in the years since the collapse. Workers from the country's garment industry, which is second only in size to China's, have been in the streets since October in the biggest demonstrations in a decade. They are demanding better wages, an end to government harassment of journalists and human rights activists, freedom of expression, and fair elections. The government's response has ranged from lethal violence, with deaths already reported among the demonstrators, to legal assaults, with suits being laid against over 23,000 workers by mid-November and over 100 arrests. A petition titled Justice for Bangladesh's Garment Workers is circulating on change.org. In environmental news, Ravel columnist Aaron Blondeau explains why Canada should stop sending the military to respond to climate disasters, but instead should create a dedicated climate youth corps. Blondeau writes, quote, "In Canada, I've been advocating for a youth climate corps alongside young people all across the country. The program we envision would be a 2-year apprenticeship with paid education and placement in climate jobs like forest management, habitat restoration, community care work, and emergency response, end quote. In recent years, the Canadian military has been embroiled in allegations of white supremacy and violence against women. Blondo explains that for these reasons, as well as its colonial legacy, the Canadian military is ill-suited to serve as a climate corps. Staying in environmental news, the 28th Conference of the Parties to the Framework Convention on Climate Change, also known as COP28, began this week in the United Arab Emirates. Environmental activist David Suzuki explains that while this year's conference is being held in an oil-producing country, there are still opportunities for progress. Suzuki explains that grassroots activism can push Canada, another oil-producing country, to be a leading voice on climate solutions. That being said, the oil and gas industry is well represented at this year's conference. Last year, some more than 600 industry lobbyists attended COP27. An increase of 25% from the previous year. And finally, Rabble contributor David Kleimenhage said that there is more smoke than fire to Alberta Premier Danielle Smith's latest threat to use her so-called Sovereignty Act. According to Smith, the Sovereignty Act will allow her government to oppose federal laws and court decisions her government doesn't agree with. Now she's threatening to use this law to oppose proposed emission regulations that the federal government is considering implementing in 2035. Kleimenhage writes, quote, "To say the introduction of the first Alberta sovereignty within a United Canada Act resolution in the Alberta legislature is performative is the understatement of the year, and the year is almost over," end quote. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to hear Rabble Radio on your local community or campus radio station? It's easy. To learn how, please email editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.